All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah! Damn, man, that music takes me just a little bit of time because to get on the air because that music is just killing me. I'm really loving it. I'm really, really loving it. It's all about the drums and the whole way I always told people that I just love the idea that drums and what they make and the rhythm that they hit in your body, and it sets you off for a whole lot of different stuff, which I'm really going to enjoy today, all right? There you go. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear an interview I did on Thursday, October 22nd, the first day of Rise Up October, with Kwame Anthony Appiah, philosopher, cultural theorist, and novelist, who was one of those who read the names of people murdered by the police at a rally in Times Square in New York City. Before that, we'll be talking with Justin Chang, chief film critic with Variety, who wrote an opinion piece on why Quentin Tarantino should not apologize. And before that, we'll be listening to an interview I did with Quentin Tarantino in the streets of New York City, walking down 6th Avenue in the Rise Up October National March to stop police terror on October 24th. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Henry Giroux, the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and Distinguished Visiting Professor at Ryerson University. And he recently wrote an article in Counterpunch magazine about terrorizing school children in the American police state. Henry, welcome to the show.
It's good to be back, Michael.
Yeah, good to hear you again, man. Let's talk about this horrendous assault on the black high school student in South Carolina. I think anybody who was human and saw that just had to, one, it just knocked the breath out of you when you saw what happened to this young woman who was pretty much hit, you know, taken out by a cop or, you know, whatever, basically beaten up by a cop pretty much for being uppity, for having an attitude. Let's talk about that. How do you situate this outrage?
Well, I think what you have to do is you have to situate this within a larger sort of war that's being waged, particularly on minority youth and on public education in general. I mean, I think that as all of a sudden the more vital role of schools as places that educate people to be engaged in critical citizens comes under attack, we increasingly find new ways to define schools. And I think that two of the ways in which we're defining them is as testing factories, which kill the imagination and prevent students from becoming critically engaged or making leaps of the imagination, holding power accountable, or as holding centers. Places that basically resemble the deep, dark logic of what I call the punishing state, where students are endlessly subjected to disciplinary practices that are just morally irresponsible, politically reprehensible, and shocking. And I think that the more we put police in the schools, the more we seem to believe that teachers should abdicate their responsibilities and not sort of, you know, take responsibility for the problems that they sometimes have to face, what we end up with are schools that are increasingly being terrorized by the police.
You know, Henry, one of the things that you mentioned in your article, you quote Margaret Kimberly and her comments on how black people are being punished in this society for, actually, when it comes right down to it, still existing. And that's one of the things that really struck me when you saw what was going on with that young woman and how that, you know, how vicious that assault was. It was simply, I mean, even, and you hear later that actually she had already put her cell phone away. She wouldn't obey his commands to get up. You know, that a little earlier, I don't know whether it was a week before or whenever, that something had happened. Her mother had just died or something. So all these sort of circumstances.
No, it's outrageous.
Yeah.
It's outrageous. I mean, this kid, Sharika is her name, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, first of all, she was put into foster care. She took out her phone for 1 second, basically. She was asked and put it back, apologized to the teacher, was apparently, from what I've read from other students, a quiet student, in no way was ruckus, in no way was causing a problem. The teacher overreacts, causing an administrator who is too stupid to simply talk to the young woman, and all of a sudden we have this guy come in who was called by the students Officer Slam, who had a reputation for being rough with students, particularly black students, and actually had a reputation for assaulting people in the past. I mean, this is a guy who shouldn't even have been in the school in the first place working with children. But I think that what's so shocking is to watch this. You really begin to get a sense of the kind of violence that permeates American society and how it's become the default mechanism for dealing with all social problems, particularly young kids and particularly minority youth. I mean, you know, as shocking as that image is, there are other images that are equally shocking. I mean, to see kids 12 years old in handcuffs, and the handcuffs are on their biceps because their wrists are too small, being led out of school. You know, you have to ask yourself, what is that symptomatic of? I mean, it's not just about the failure of American education. It's symptomatic of a society that's become so increasingly authoritarian and right-wing and extreme in its politics and its moral sensibilities that we're on the verge of something which is really dark, dire, and threatening, to say the least, to American democracy.
Now, tell me this, Henry. You talk about something you call punishment creep in your in your article. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, what I argue is that as the welfare state, the social state, social provisions, those commitments that uphold the social contract are increasingly vilified and defiled by these right-wing morons such as Ben Carson and others, Paul Ryan, what you have basically is you have a rise in what I call the punishing state, and you have the rise in what I call punishment creep, meaning that the prison as a model and its rituals and its values and its practices and its mechanisms now begin to move into other institutions, from airports to social services to schools. And so schools start replicating and start looking, in this particular instance, actually like prisons, where you have all kinds of surveillance mechanisms, security measures, police in the schools, guards. I mean, I think that what you basically see is you see the hardening of a culture and a society. Its most dire expression is that the prison becomes the model for addressing social problems. The other side of this is that you have an increasing, what I would call, development of the criminalization of social behaviors, behaviors that should not be criminalized are now criminalized. You know, I mean, people, you know, who are homeless, you know, all of a sudden are taken to jail rather than given social provisions. And you know, people walking while black, you know, Freddie Gray making eye contact with a student, violating a dress code, throwing peanuts at a bus. Good Lord. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, Ferguson, where what 3/4 of the population basically was provided a source of revenue for the police department, and all kinds of minor infractions were violations, were seen as criminal violations that, you know, sucked money out of the community and in many cases often put people in jail.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Henry Giroux, and we're talking about Henry's article on terrorizing school children in the American police state, which is available on Counterpunch. Is it also available on Truth Out?
It will be, hopefully.
Okay, it will be. Good.
A more extended version.
Okay, great, great. Looking forward to that.
Now, in that version, I talk about Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll talk about that towards the end of this a little bit. One of the things I wanted to ask you, though, when you're talking about all this, what I got a sense of, and you make this point in your article, and it's something that's very heavy. I don't think people really realize this, that there actually is this punishment creep, this punishment state. What's unleashed in the schools actually means that, you know, I used to think it was just like I went to Catholic school, so I had insane nuns that would beat me with sticks. And, you know,
I did too.
Yeah, okay. So right. So we understand where the evil was then. But now you're talking about there's actually a war being waged against students, and particularly minority students. And it's real when you look at, like, a point you made that the biggest growth in police has been in the school police, which is amazing when you think about it.
I mean, I think that when you start, you know, look, if for a long time people were talking about how a variety of states were investing more in prisons and in higher education, and you know, people didn't really take that seriously as an index of anything that sort of suggested something more symptomatic of what was going on in the wider society. But I've argued repeatedly for quite a while that what we see in the United States is what I call a hard war and a soft war, what I call a surveillance war, the control war. I mean, these are three registers of a war on youth that suggest that this is a country that no longer wants to invest in young people. It basically wants to punish them. Young people are no longer a source of investment and no longer seen as at risk. They are the risk, and particularly minority youth. And I think that we see it in a whole range of ways, from the endless commodification to the school-to-prison pipeline to the endless amounts of surveillance that young people are now being sort of pushed into. And it augurs something awful. I mean, this really suggests a kind of collective assault on the part of the state that, to me, represents a form of domestic terrorism.
You know, it's very heavy. And actually, and it has consequences. Just so people understand, the real consequences of this, you point out in your article, just this fact alone, which should be enough to stun people, that the use of violence in schools has been so heavy that 28 students have been seriously injured, including one shot to death. You know,
these stories are all too familiar. I mean, as you know, in that piece, there's one story about a cop who punches a 13-year-old in the face. And another one beats a student with a baton who's 12 or 13 years old. And this is outside of Tamir Rice and, you know, kids being actually killed, right, and murdered. And then there are stories about kids being in comas, or there are stories about kids who have tried to break up fights and instead have been assaulted by the security guards and put into the hospital. I mean, there are real consequences here around the very question, not just simply of young people's dignity being assaulted, but their lives being threatened. And I think that when you all of a sudden turn schools into places that are no longer safe spaces, but instead become spaces where they could actually lose their lives or be punished or be injured in really serious ways, I think it's time to rethink, you know, what the underlying root causes and forces are that are producing these kinds of violent assaults.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, exactly. And this, you know, there's this whole change in the character of the schools that you're talking about that actually, and I found this pretty heavy when you were talking about this, that actually the schools, one, that this whole authority, this martial authority over students is actually the job now of the police, not the school police, not the, you know, Andy of Mayberry or Barney Fife going down there and sitting in the corner and watching the students make sure everything's okay and occasionally telling them, hey, don't do this. But it's actually run by the police. And then in New York City, the school police answer directly to the police, not to the administrators of the school.
That's true, Michael, in a lot of cities. And I think that's horrendous. And actually, you have had principals in New York City and some of the schools complain about this, that they have no control over this. I mean, there are instances that the Advancement Fund and the Children's Defense Fund have actually talked about students going through security measures and being whistled at and being harassed by students, young women, where you've had sexual assaults in some cases, symbolically and literally. And, you know, nothing can be done. I mean, it's very difficult to control some of these people. They're really out of control because they can act with impunity. And it seems to me that the question that has to be raised here is, where are the unions in this? I mean, why have the unions allowed this to take place? I mean, you know, the teachers' union is some of the most powerful unions in the United States, and they're allowing police in the schools. You had mentioned something earlier. When you and I were kids, although you're younger than I am, when we were kids, but I think we shared something in that if you had a disciplinary problem was not seen as a criminal offense unless a kid brought a gun to school. I mean, there was a distinction between somebody who basically doodled on their desk and somebody who shot another student. We didn't criminalize student behavior. Students were not treated as criminals. They were treated as young kids, whose brains actually were still developing. And so people would pull me aside. You know, I was a working-class kid from a tough neighborhood. And, you know, people would pull me aside and slap me in the back of the head gently and say, look, hey, cut the you know, you know better than this. And that was it, man. I got the message. But I never saw a cop in a school when I was a kid. And I went to a rough school. I never saw a policeman in a school. The other side of this, Michael, is something that should be mentioned. In that piece, and the audience needs to hear this, you know, since the police have been in the schools in the United States, one of the things that we've noticed is that the citations for disciplinary infractions have quadrupled. Quadrupled. More police, more infractions. More kids going into the criminal justice system. More kids finding their lives ruined. You know, more kids all of a sudden who don't have the funds and can't hire lawyers find themselves in this endless loop in which the criminal justice system now endlessly punishes them. I mean, I find that horrendous.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, Henry, I want to ask you this. You know, you point out that you're pointing all this out, and there's actually this theme in your article. There's a backbone to your article that actually talks about how black students in particular are increasingly being regarded as criminals and how that shapes school life. And then you quote Roxane Gay saying, black children are no longer allowed to be children. And as I read that, I kept thinking of Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, Tamir Rice, on and on and on. And that's a fairly heavy situation when you have a whole people that is, you know, generally being told, I mean, they're the target of mass incarceration. They're black and brown people, mainly the target of police murder. All these things that happen that are built in the fact that this society really no longer has a way to embrace or need for millions and millions and millions of black people. And so the whole idea is then, what do you do? Repression. And it has to do with the school thing that you were talking about, of the crushing of the brains, and then the violence enforcing all this. This is a very heavy, heavy situation in terms of this being unleashed all, even against black children.
I mean, I think that when you sacrifice children in the interest of consolidating basically an authoritarian society, an authoritarian state, you know, you have to raise larger questions here, and that is, whatever happened to democracy? What role does education have to play in a democracy? And if it doesn't play that role, what kind of democracy do you have? Well, the fact of the matter is you probably don't have one anymore. And I think that while we need to be, what's school children are the canary in the cave. I mean, once we start attacking children with impunity, it seems to me that everything is at risk. Because if you can't respect the possibility for creating the conditions for future generations to live a life with dignity and to expand and deepen the promise of democracy itself, that means you've given up on two things. You've given up on the question of social responsibility and morality, and you've given up on the ideals of democracy. So the question becomes, what's left?
You know, here's the thing, too, is that, and this always happens, and it happens in everything that comes down, and it's from the police murders where they say, well, he did this, or he did that, or she did this, or she did that. And you make the point that there's involved in the normalization of all this is that Black people are so often told that what happens to them is because they won't go along with the program, that they've acted out of place, that it's their own fault. This is why this is coming down. They have only themselves to blame.
Oh, this is a terrible racist script. I mean, it's an old script. It goes back to slavery. And every racist apologist in the world seems to use it. And we now see it happening with the kind of police violence that's becoming more and more visible in the United States against Black adults and young people. I mean, I think that when I hear people saying that, you know, we can't criticize the police because that basically endangers public safety, I mean, that to me is a very dangerous discourse because it suggests that the police are the victims. And it's a line of argument we've heard from Obama, from James Comey, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And, of course, now we hear it from the various police chiefs throughout the United States in their attack on Quentin Tarantino, who had the enormous courage to say that police violence has to stop. I mean, I think that when you sort of suggest that the violence propagated by the police should not be subject to public scrutiny, believe me, you are in the midst of an authoritarian society. Because what comes next is the repression of dissent, and then what comes next is actually putting people in jail for dissenting. That kind of argument is good for Chile under Pinochet, but it's not good for the United States. It's a disservice to everybody.
Yeah, all right, Henry, I can't think of where I want to go with this anymore because I think we've covered everything, and I'm really appreciative of you for coming on today. This is a very heavy subject, and I have to tell you, when I read it, I was very moved by it. I thought, and I think people should really pick this up, look at it. It's Terrorizing School Children in the American Police State. It's currently on Counterpunch, and it's also going to be an extended version of that. Will be on Truthout soon. So get home today, Henry, and write it and get it up.
I will.
All right, Henry.
Thank you, Michael.
And listen, we'll also link to it on my website as well. And look forward. I'm in the middle of reading Dangerous Thinking in the Age of New Authoritarianism, so we're going to have you back real soon, okay?
I'd love to talk about that book.
All right, great. All right, Henry. So look forward to talking to you
Bye-bye.
Again. Take care now. Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Henry Giroux. And Henry is the McMaster Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and Distinguished Visiting Professor at Ryerson University. And he recently wrote about terrorizing schoolchildren in the American Police State, and the article is called Terrorizing Schoolchildren in the American Police State. And we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, you'll be listening to my interview with Quentin Tarantino as we walk down 6th Avenue in the middle of Rise Up October on October 24th, so stay tuned.
I went rolling down that ribbon of highway. This land is my land, isn't what I'd say. Signs that I'm passing last, no trespassing, cash rules everything, which means I'm just a target. Prophet to God, that's king on the market. Bring on the rocket launchers that knock us all unconscious. 30,000 children dying every year who don't have to and still get killed. That's why I ask you, how many mothers cried today? How many looked up at the sky and prayed to try to find a way? Yeah, how many children died today? How many workers gave their lives away so you could live it up? Huh? How many mothers cried
today? All right. That Sunrise Above with The Human Cost. All right. Quentin Tarantino on October 22nd showed up to join in a reading of the names of people who have been killed by the police over the many, many years since actually... The Stolen Lives Project began back in the mid-90s, and it was a very moving event. He was joined by people like Eve Ensler, a number of people that came up, and there was a whole crowd of people that were out there to honor that, and people read those names with a lot of solemnity, a lot of feeling, a lot of just real desire to stand up and say, stop this. And then on October 24th, Quentin Tarantino joined in a march that was the big march that was called for thousands of people to be in New York City to march down Sixth Avenue and to go and bring out the call for an end to police terror and murder. And it was a good starting point in drawing a very, very clear line in society, asking people, insisting that people speak to which side are you on, because there's no middle ground on this, brothers and sisters. There's no middle ground. You know, and what I want to do is I want to play an interview that I did with Quentin Tarantino. And if you have been any at all awake in this society, you've seen the horrendous assault that Tarantino has come under over the last couple of weeks for simply saying his conscience, okay? I had a chance to interview him shortly after the rally where he made the comments that he's being attacked for. And I want you to hear this. As we were marching down Sixth Avenue in the middle of it all, I had a chance to talk with Quentin Tarantino, and here it is. So check this out.
Quentin Tarantino, you came out on Thursday, and it was very moving. I mean, I was there just listening to those stories. And then you come out today, and you're pretty, you know, it's pretty important that you're out here, like your voice is out here. What made you feel compelled to be here?
Well, what made me feel compelled, basically, is I'm a person, I'm a human being, and I have a conscience. And I've been sitting here, and I've been watching for, you know, it's been going on for a long time, but for the last year and a half, it seems like you just see one black or brown man, a woman, killed, murdered by the police, unarmed. And I believe that there is I believe there's a problem in the police culture itself that is corrupt, and the culture needs to be changed. And the thing about it is, if I actually do feel that it is murder and it's not extenuating circumstances, then I have an obligation to stand with the murdered against the murderers. And that's what I'm doing here.
Yeah. Now, do you ever, you know, a lot of people have made the reference to a genocide, a slow genocide, yes, but a genocide that's in formation and actually taking place as we go along. What do you think of that?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, to me, the whole mass incarceration situation that's been going on for the last 20 years, I think 30, 40 years from now, people will call it Slavery Part 2, American Slavery Part 2. And this is all, and that is a byproduct, and both, and that issue and this issue are married to each other. They're linked in arms.
Absolutely.
And look, go ahead. My job isn't to be the most eloquent person speaking on this subject that there is. There's a whole lot more people here more eloquent than me, but I can put my body here.
Right, and also it does make a difference if your voice is heard.
Yeah.
You know, because look, there's people in society who have disproportionate influence based on the work that they do in a lot of times, in your case in particular.
Yeah.
So it makes it, and no matter what it is, it's actually important when someone like you comes out and stands up and says, look, I see what's going on. I can't sit there and pretend I don't.
That's the thing. I mean, one of the things about the movement that actually just means so much is there's, you know, they have a powerful slogan. Which side are you on? You know, if you're not on our side, you're on their side. There is no straddling the fence. There's no silent majority. There is none of that. You have to take a stand. If you believe it's murder, then you got to call it murder. And you got to call the murderers murderers.
Absolutely. Just one more and we'll be through. Two more. One is the Niemöller quotes have been coming up in my mind a lot in relation to this. You know, first they came for these people and I didn't say anything, and it goes down the line.
There's
the second one that he talked about that a lot of people don't talk about, which is what, and it speaks to this last point you made. What if, when he got out of the concentration camp, he said, I have to think, what if we had stood up? What if we had spoken out? What if we had done something? Think of how many lives might not have been taken.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's just like, and it's, I do, you know, it's funny. A lot of people here involved in this movement, some of them are very different minds about what should be done. And some of them are for all-out revolution. I like the idea of that, but I actually think I don't think that's the only answer. I actually do think that massive resistance, which is what this is, can stop this, can put a pause in it, can put a second thought in it with these cops. And I do believe that there is a corrupt culture inside of the police force that needs to be straightened out. They are just too authoritative. Nobody should be stopped and actually have no rights during that encounter until later. That's just untenable.
Yes, exactly. What would you say to people who hear your voice now? What would you say to them about what they need to be doing?
Well, if you don't believe the way we believe, sorry, honey, if you don't believe it the way we believe, well, then you don't, and then that's where you stand.
Yes,
But if you believe where we're coming from, and you believe that it is murder, and you believe people are being killed, then you have to say something. You have to join. You have to stand up. You have to join with us. And there's a lot of different ways you can do that, but you need to. Now, because that's the only way it's going to stop.
Right. That was, I was just going to ask you, how actually do you see it being made to stop?
I actually do think that if this happens enough, and it actually becomes, you know, like a 60s movement thing in a real way, which actually would be very interesting, because the civil rights movement was led by young people in the 60s. This is being led by moms. This is being led by fathers. This is being led by family members, and young people are catching up. And that's a really terrific thing. And so I think that it literally can be a situation is if it comes out there, then we can change the police force. We can change the way the police academy teach people, how they teach the police. And we can get rid of some of these cops. You should have a higher calling to be a cop. You know, there's like a whole thing of, we expect our doctors to aspire to a higher calling, not just have a job. We expect the people who work, the paramedics and the ambulances, we expect them to aspire to a higher calling, not just have a job. All right, and we need to expect that from the police. They're not just having a job and things happen.
All right, Quentin Tarantino, thank you very much for talking to us today. Take care.
All right, welcome back. That was my interview with Quentin Tarantino on October 24th, marching down 6th Avenue in New York City as part of the Rise Up October, Which Side Are You On? Demonstration. Joining us now to talk about the Quentin Tarantino episode is Justin Chang, and Justin is the chief film critic for Variety, and he recently wrote an opinion piece on why Quentin Tarantino shouldn't apologize. Jason, welcome to the show. Justin.
Right, yeah.
I'm sorry. I kept saying Jason.
No problem.
I don't know why. Okay.
Well, I've been called it all my life.
All right. So why Quentin Tarantino shouldn't apologize? What the hell are you talking about there, man?
Well, I think that, I mean, you know, looking at this issue, I was just, you know, kind of scanning the headlines and kind of keeping up. You know, and look, you know, Quentin Tarantino kind of, you know, speaking his mind is certainly nothing new. Quentin Tarantino making people angry through some of the things that he says is nothing new. But I was sort of appalled by just the kind of coordinated, unified kind of response. We're going to boycott your movie. I mean, and look, it's worth saying that, you know, Tarantino is absolutely free to speak his mind on the subject, and the police unions are free to call for a boycott. I mean, but I just find that to be such a, you know, a spiteful and pathetic kind of response, you know, to sort of, you know, and I think in there therein lies sort of a real contempt for artists too, and the not only the right that artists have to kind of speak to the issues in our present day society, but just, you know, the insight that they bring. And, you know, I think Tarantino, I wish that more people were speaking out alongside him. You know, I think that he sort of almost, you know, by being, you know, kind of a white mainstream figure, you know, of that stature kind of speaking on this issue, he kind of almost made himself a big target because of the sheer kind of paucity of people out there who are kind of saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this, Justin. I think what you're saying is very much to the point and very heavy. And the thing is that when you look at it, on just starting back on one thing, is when you look at it and people keep postulating, well, why did he say this? Why did he say this? And I listened to the interview that I did with him. I listened to what he said.
Yeah.
And he started out with, I'm a human being with a conscience.
Yeah. And I think he's been kind of reiterating that. And, you know, and there's a lot of people who are kind of, I think, second-guessing why him. And part of the answer to that, of course, is, well, why not? You know, this is an important, you know, it's like, and especially if you agree with them, and if you, you know, and as, you know, as you do, Michael, and as I do, you know, kind of care about what has been going on with Black Lives Matter, with that movement, with speaking out against police brutality. It's like, he has every right to do that. But I think, you know, people have been saying that, you know, Tarantino gave this interview, you know, and then again, he sort of, you know, and it was kind of an obnoxious, you know, and yet kind of delightfully Tarantino-esque interview where he was sort of speaking his mind. and where he said, you know, if you're, you know, he addressed kind of his black critics in particular. I think we're talking, you know, mainly film critics and cultural critics, you know, arts writers, saying that if you're, you know, if you're a critic in black culture or a black critic, and if you've been working in, you know, for the past 20 years, you have to deal with me and you have to have an opinion of my work. You can't be a black critic or a critic in black culture and not have an opinion of what I say and where I stand. And, you know, and he made a lot of people angry with that remark, which I think is kind of an obnoxious sort of comment and yet kind of a hard one to refute as well. And so, in a way, you know, I don't want to speculate as to what turned. I think, first and foremost, yes, I would agree with you. I think he was speaking from his conscience. I think he's very cognizant, too, of the fact, though, that if he is claiming a place within this culture, as he's done, I think, starting from when he started making movies and even beforehand, he needs to, in a way, I think he's showing that he's willing to take a stand on the issues that are of the most pressing and painful concern to the black community, of which, and so he's, I think he's sort of trying to maybe calm down or quell the kind of accusation that he's sort of appropriating black culture in a way that is not good.
Well, you know, one thing, Justin, it's very heavy here, too, because, you know, it's also true. I was speaking to some people last week about this history of when artists speak out on critical issues of the day. And this is one of the most critical issues of the day, the wanton slaughter of, I mean, really, literally, when you talk, you look at the combination of mass incarceration and the, just this year, I mean, it will be over 1,000 people this year that we know of that have been killed by the police, and more than 300 of them proven to be unarmed with anything, you know, not even a spoon, as they're always talking about. And the system really hits hard at these artists when they stand up. And Tarantino is not the first to speak out against police brutality and murder, but he has been hit much harder than a lot of people in recent times. Mm-hmm. The last time I can think of something anywhere near this is when the cops went after Ed Asner in Rage Against the Machine for standing up against what the system was doing to Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is a fairly heavy thing. Why do you think they're hitting at Tarantino so hard like this?
Well, I think that another reason why Tarantino has perhaps made himself an especial target in this case is because, well, he makes violent movies. And if you listen to the really, I think, really uninformed kind of rantings of some of the spokespeople for the police unions, they think that the fact that Tarantino makes violent movies and, quote-unquote, glorifies violence disqualifies him from speaking to this issue. And I think that is a ridiculous opinion to hold. I think, you know, and I think they're, it kind of, you know, and look, the debate over Tarantino's movies and do they promote a culture of violence? Do they kind of cater to audience bloodlust? And if they do they do that in a way that is kind of safe and constructive and cathartic, or they do it in a way that is likely to, you know, spur copycat crimes? You know, and this kind of debate has been going on. It's Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, you know, you name it. I mean, he makes these, I think, brilliant and kind of exuberantly violent movies. I don't think he glorifies violence. I think, you know, if anything, it's funny, Tarantino, if anything, he glorifies cinema because his movies are all about just how great movies are. But I think that the point, though, is like, even if he does, and even if you kind of think he's being hypocritical, that doesn't take away his right to speak out. And I think the fact that he said that, you know, he prefaces interview with you and also his remarks on stage with saying, I'm a human being with a conscience, I almost feel like I hear in that it's kind of a way of him saying, yeah, I almost need to reiterate that, because there's some people who think that I'm not. They think that I am some kind of nihilist, or that because I make violent movies that there's something kind of subhuman about me. And so I think he is sort of, you know, I think there's something really great about that he's sort of reclaiming, you know, I don't think he, you know, for me, it's like, it's not that Tarantino ever had to reclaim his humanity, but I think for those people who would write him off in this way, he's saying, no, I do care. And guess what? I can differentiate between the violence that I put on screen and the violence that I see happening in our society.
Very important point. Now, Justin, I have a couple of quick questions for you. One is, you're a critic, and this is normally sort of the kind of op-ed piece you did, I would think, would be kind of a stretch for you in terms of what you normally do. Why did you feel compelled to speak to this?
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, the kind of, the op-ed waters are not ones that I wade into all that frequently. But, you know, obviously this is something that connected with, you know, it was, you know, a hugely pressing, important, maybe the issue of the day at this point in time, intersecting with a really powerful figure in film culture and beyond film culture as well. I was just kind of, you know, scanning the headlines after, you know, Tarantino made his remarks, and I was just a little appalled at, not only at the police response, but that nobody really seemed to be speaking for the other, speaking for the other side, and so much of the coverage of it was, I think, just so low. When they trotted out Tarantino's estranged father to kind of, you know, disown or condemn, I mean, not disown, but like to condemn his son's remarks, saying, you know, it just, it, like, what a, you know, what a ludicrous, meaningless spectacle that was, you know, and I just felt, and I think the what really kind of did set me off, I think, was, were the remarks coming from Patrick Lynch in particular, sort of condemning Tarantino, saying he's a cop hater, saying that he glorifies crime and violence. He has no business coming to New York, kind of peddling his cop fiction. It's like, well, actually, he has every business to do that. Everyone has has the right to go to New York and speak their mind. I mean, this is not, you know, that is a simple exercise of one's First Amendment rights. And I just felt it was an interesting way, you know, writing that piece in which, you know, I hopefully, you know, lay things out a little more clearly than I may be doing at this moment. I just thought it was an interesting way to kind of merge film criticism and a little bit of social commentary. I think, too, you know, the issue of boycotting is interesting to me. You know, you look at some filmmakers, and maybe they don't spur anything like so dramatic as a nationwide boycott. But because of certain maybe questionable moral behavior, I mean, you look at Woody Allen, Roman Polanski, you know, these are filmmakers who, you know, due to various sexual scandals or rumors of sexual scandals in their past, you know, they're the kind of people, I know friends and colleagues, who's like, oh, I will never watch a movie made by those directors because I disagree with what they've done or what I think they've done. And I'm always interested in that issue of, like, setting the morality of the artist or what we perceive as the morality of the artist and the artist's output. And there are so many great films made by not so great people. And I've always been of the mind that we should judge the art by itself, take into account other factors as well, but letting the work speak for itself. And so here's just Quentin Tarantino just kind of speaking out, speaking his mind, and he hasn't done anything wrong, and, you know, of a comparable nature. So I just found it so, you know, I mean, honestly, I mean, and I'm a critic. I'm looking forward to the movie. I have no financial investment or I have no investment in the movie whatsoever beyond I just hope it's good. And just reading that, it made me want to go out and buy out a multiplex ticket. which is, you know, maybe sort of a silly and childish response, but I just think that's kind of the level that they're thinking. Kind of everyone's thinking sort of regresses to a childish level, I think, when tempers are raised. Yeah, I do think that there is something to be said for being more temperate, considered about this, because they're just trying to, like, I'm sure you've seen the most recent headlines where the police, I don't know which organization it was, but they're this kind of making this not so veiled threat against Tarantino, like, we're going to give you some kind of, you know, there's some surprise that's coming your way, not threatening physical violence, but we're going to hit you where you live. And it's like, this is scary.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Borderline Stalinist kind of stuff. How can you not speak up?
Well, Justin, one quick question, and we only have about a minute and a half for this, so I'll ask the question real fast. You actually, in all that you've been saying about Tarantino, and you make this point in your review, in your article, to your op-ed piece too, where you say that what he's saying and the kind of way that he speaks and puts things out before people now carries the unmistakable feel of an invitation, and that maybe the real problem isn't what Quentin Tarantino is saying, but that there aren't more people saying it with him. Let's talk about that for a minute.
And I think that, this is where I sort of went into maybe the tricky territory thing, saying that because Quentin Tarantino is a white man who has an affinity and a comfort with black culture, you know, he feels compelled to say this, but there are not a lot of people, I think, who look like Tarantino who have that kind of stature. I mean, I don't want to name names of who I'd like to see. I mean, that's not for me to do. Mm-hmm. Everyone has to kind of operate according to their conscience. But I just think that Tarantino would be less of a target if he were not the first or maybe the only person filmmaker. And, you know, there were other people, of course, who were at that rally, and Steve Ensler and, you know, Dr. Cornel West and, you know, and whatnot. And they, you know, there were so many speakers. And I think there is something about Tarantino, you know, he is the person that we go to for kind of unfiltered, aggressive commentary. So some people will say that he brought this on himself just by being so outspoken. But I think that's why he's vital. And I think that's why he's a vital voice. And I know that, I don't know what regrets he or, you know, anyone has, but I'm glad he opened his mouth.
You and me both, Justin, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
And hey, let's go to the movie sometimes, man. Let's go see this opening, okay? And stay in touch, man. Yeah, and we'll stay in touch because I find your work very interesting. All right, so we'll stay in touch, man. All right,
appreciate that. Thank you.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Justin Chang, chief film critic at Variety, and we've been talking about his piece, Why Quentin Tarantino Shouldn't Apologize. It's an op-ed piece, not a review of a film, but a very important op-ed piece for a whole lot of people to read, to check out, and we will link to that on my website as well, which is
themichaelslateshow.com, all right? Go there and find it all out, okay? And we'll be linking to everything we did today.
We'll be right back after a quick musical break, so stay tuned.
Fit for rhyme, BS fit to spit. The hate produced, thrown up in a noose. Most them history pages come in all stages, colors, genders, and ages.
Devil.
Black, brown, yellow, red, but white. Supremacy, tendency, and currency. Estrogen, robbing my oxygen. Still dissing skin, inform my next of kin.
Get in the back of the car.
What?
Let's go.
All right, that was No Sympathy from the Devil by Public Enemy, brand new album. Kwame Anthony Appiah is a philosopher, cultural theorist, and novelist whose interests include political and moral theory, the philosophy of language and mind, and African intellectual history. He currently holds an appointment at NYU's Department of Philosophy and NYU's School of Law, and he is the writer on ethics for the New York Times. On October 22nd, he joined Eve Ensler, Quentin Tarantino, Jamal Joseph, Gina Belafonte, and others in Times Square to read some of the names of the thousands of people who have been killed by police in recent years. I spoke with him shortly after he spoke. Tell me something. You've been involved in this. You were one of the people reading the names today of the people killed by the police.
Yes.
What is it that compelled you to come up and do this?
I think that anybody who has any sense of civic responsibility has to be involved when their country is doing something seriously wrong. It's being done in our name. It's being done in our name, and so we're responsible for it in that sense. And when I was asked if I would come and participate in this, which is an event that aims to draw attention to the fact that we have too many people being killed by police in our country, too many black people, too many white people, too many Latino people, too many men, too many women are being killed, and we have to figure out what to do about it. And it's not going to stop if we don't use our collective wisdom and our collective power as citizens to change course. And as many of the speakers said, this is not about hostility to the police. The murders are done by people who are bringing dishonor to their uniform. They're bringing dishonor to the system. And so we must hope that more and more cops will come to see that the way of justice is also the way to be a policeman, police officer. The way to be a police officer is not to cover up, not to draw the thin blue line and refuse to take action against your colleagues who are doing these abusive things. The way of justice, proper policing, includes making sure that your fellow cops don't do to these terrible things. What happens when you discuss these cases is that people pick some case where they think it was justified. I'm prepared to admit that sometimes people are shot by policemen in our country in circumstances where it's warranted because they're defending themselves or they're defending somebody else. I'm not denying that. But if you just look all through all these cases, that isn't all that's going on. What's going on is that ordinary people who should be able to rely on the cops to protect them are being shot and killed in other ways. And as I say, if you're just a moderately honorable citizen, you care about what your country's doing. And so if somebody asks you to come and speak out against it, and not just to speak out against it, but to try and think about how we can do something about it, why wouldn't you?
Let me ask you this, because one of the things I've been thinking about, having been involved in this a long time myself, and looking at the numbers of people, and just the numbers that we know, I mean, they're horrifying.
Yes.
You know, and if you took just an average number of 1,000 a year, we're talking, going back 20 years, 20,000 people, and that's what we know about.
Yes.
Now, the question that comes up for me is this question of genocide. And it's an ethical question. It's a philosophical question that's been posed many, many times, in particular in places where, whether it was Indonesia or whether it was Nazi Germany. And the fact that too many people turned their head away and allowed this kind of thing to go on. Do you see any danger in relation to what's happening here now?
I myself don't think that the concept of genocide is very helpful in this particular context. But one thing that is helpful in this context is an idea that comes from thinking about genocide, which is the idea of being an active bystander. That is, the idea that when these terrible things happen, they happen in part because ordinary people who could do something stand by and don't intervene. And I think one of the things that's actually been moving for me in these recent years is the way in which people have just taken the trouble to record what's going on. People had nothing to do with it, people who don't know the people who are being attacked by the police. And they're acting responsibly, they're being active bystanders, and then they have to decide if they have the courage to send the material to the authorities, because in a country where, unfortunately, some of these crimes are covered up, people have a reason to worry about whether they're safe when they report these things. But I'm moved by the fact that people have decided that one thing, it's one of the good things about this new technology, is it allows ordinary, it empowers ordinary citizens to do one useful thing, which is just to be a witness, and a witness of an impeccable kind, because you can say, it's not just me that says this happened, here's this videotape. Now, you know, videotapes have to be interpreted and they can be misinterpreted. I'm not saying that there aren't risks there as there are with human testimony, but the fact is, it makes a big difference. Many of these cases, we would never have been able to focus on them as a nation and think about what's wrong and think about what we want to do about them if we hadn't had the film.
Well, think, if Walter Scott killed in South Carolina, yeah. That young man hadn't been there, an immigrant, who's actually has a whole other set of threats against him. If he hadn't decided that it was morally necessary to turn that thing in, we would have just known Walter Scott as a guy who tried to steal a cop's gun, tased him, ran away, and was killed in the line of duty.
Right. So it would have been a normal police killing.
Yeah.
Yes. So I do feel that that's one of the lessons from these larger historical occasions, when the reason I don't think it's terribly helpful to think of this in terms of the concept of genocide is because this is terrible, but it's not the result of an intentional government policy to eradicate a part of the population. I know there are people who think it is, but I'm not among them. That's why I don't think it's helpful. It's bad enough that it's the result of laziness, malice, incompetence, and a bunch of other unpleasant things.
Although there is an element, though, I would say, there is an element, if you look at, like, particularly with the situation of black people in America today, where there are people, I mean, look, you look at what Michelle Alexander has exposed in relation to mass incarceration. Mm. There is an element of this, of a people that's no longer needed, and a people that's also a very sharp contradiction for a system, because people do rise up, they do rebel, and they do raise deep questions and fissures in society. And to me, that is something that sort of, I think, actually plays into this whole question of the character of what's happening in terms of police.
Well, there's no doubt that the scale of incarceration in our country is a scandal. And the fact that it has a racial character, I mean, we have too many people of every color in prison by any reasonable standard. But we particularly have too many black people. And we not only have too many black people in prison, but we have too many black people on probation. We have too many black people being stopped and frisked. So it's perfectly clear that the whole problem is terrible and has a racial character. Though it's very important not to forget that of the third of the people shot by police in our country now, roughly, are people of color. But that means two-thirds of them are not black. Well, they're black people. Two-thirds of them are other people of color and white people. And that's terrible, too.
Right.
Now, 30% is an awful lot in a country where you're only 12% of the population, so it shows that it has a racial character. But the fundamental problem is that we're killing and incarcerating too many human beings. And I frankly don't have a very good account of why that is, because we are way out there in terms of the statistics, way out there from the standards of other industrial nations. Actually, no country in the world incarcerates at our rate except the Seychelles, and it's a tiny country, and the UN imprisons pirates there. So that's why they have a high rate of incarceration. But we have a preposterously high rate of incarceration. On the other hand, it is worth noticing that our incarceration rates vary enormously by state. Louisiana, which is the most incarcerating state in the nation, incarcerates at a rate whose multiple of the incarceration rate in New York is of the same order as the American average is the multiple of what's going on in France, say. So Are you surprised that I mentioned Louisiana? I'm not sure that you are.
Not at all.
So again, this shows, I think, something to do with the fact that this is a reflection of the great racial fault line in our country. I think what's going on in Louisiana just wouldn't happen in a community that was not racially divided. There are too many white people in Louisiana prisons too. And the fact that Louisiana is a highly incarcerating society has many explanations. But the fact is that there is a connection, it turns out, always between our racial pathology and the other social pathologies that we are living with. I don't know. I mean, I get depressed thinking about these things, not because I get depressed about thinking about bad stuff, because I don't feel very hopeful about... You can't just tell people something bad is going on, you have to tell them something to do about it. It's just depressing to be told that something bad is going on. And I think that I'm mildly optimistic. The incarceration rate is going down. There is now a broad consensus, which is not, it's not just people on the left. There are now even conservative people who realize that there are moral and prudential reasons why our incarceration rate is not good for the country. It's obviously not good for the people in prison and their families. And that's enough of a reason in my view. But even if you didn't care about them, it's terrible for the country. So I think that the argument has taken a very long time, and that's what's depressing. But I think the argument is being won. And so I'm in that way, when I get depressed, then I think, well, maybe we are beginning to win the argument, and people are realizing. The president even has started pardoning some people, trying to reduce federal prison numbers. I suspect he'll do more before he leaves office, since the federal pardon power is one of the things that a president can do that nobody's allowed to question. It's completely discretionary. So I'm optimistic, a little bit optimistic, but we have a very, very long way to go on the incarceration question, because we have so many people in prison, so many prisons.
One more question, and this goes back to our friend Niemöller.
Yes?
People know about his, well, when they came for these people, I didn't say anything, and then it works down to when they came for me, there was nobody left to say anything. A lot of people aren't aware of the other statement that he made when he came out of the concentration camp he was put in, and he posed the question as to what a difference it would have made, how the world might have been different, how things might have been different if more people had spoken up. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, the hope of a movement like this one, which I'm just invited here today, I'm not one of the organizers, but the hope of a movement like this one is that more people will speak up. And in the end, we have a very imperfect democracy, but in the end, if enough people care about something in our very imperfect democracy, there's an incentive for political representatives to do something about it. And so I think it is important for lots of people to say their truths about these things and to have events like this, and the ones that will be going on in the next couple of days in New York and around the country, just to raise the number of people who are speaking about these things. And who I try to talk about mass incarceration most of the occasions that I talk in public, because it's relevant to what stuff I do. So I'm not imposing on people by, they didn't ask me to come and talk about French movies and I start talking about mass incarceration. They asked me to talk about ethics, they asked me to talk about justice, they asked me to talk about honor. Well, mass incarceration is an issue of justice and ethics and honor, and so I feel it's appropriate to talk about it. And what I find is that a lot of young people, I mean, first of all, more than when I started, say, 10 years ago, more young people already know that we are a preposterously incarcerating society, which they didn't. But also, more people think, yeah, that's right, terrible thing, we shouldn't be doing it, so they want to do something about it. And that means they do all kinds of things. Some of them are involved in prison education programs. Some of them are working to support people who want to have programs of amnesty and so on. I mean, I think there are things to be done, which is why I'm not so depressed. If it were just a problem and one couldn't think of anything to do about it, that would be depressing. But I think there are real programs out there of action that people have come up with. And against the background of more people speaking about it and having a stronger, more widespread sense in the society that something is wrong, one can, I think, eventually hope that there might be real change on this issue. Now, I know you think that we need to change the whole system.
Right. And my face gives that away.
And if we change the whole system, I'm sure that this would not be... If your system, in the form that you would hope, came into being, we wouldn't be talking about this. I'm a more... have a more... of a narrower view of what we need to do, a less ambitious and less revolutionary view. But I think you and I can both agree that since, as it were, until revolution comes, there's lots to be done anyway. And one can't wait to solve. Sometimes the best is the enemy of the good. Sometimes people are so focused on changing the big picture that they forget that they can make difference in the small picture. And I think this is one of these places where kind of city by city and state by state and federal law by federal law, we can improve things. Though there's just no easy way to get millions of people reintegrated in the short run. I mean, one of the problems with our, it's not just that we have too many people in prison, it's what we do to people in prison, and in particular what we don't do. The International Convention, the International Covenant on Political Rights, the UN one, says that the function of a penitentiary is both to punish and to prepare people to be reintegrated. We've forgotten that. And forgetting that is a breach of our obligations in international law. It's not a trivial matter. And we really have. There's so little work in prisons. And then when people are released, if someone's been taken away all this time, they have no resources, they have no bank account, no money, and you give them $50 and put them on a bus, what do you expect them to do? Right? I mean, what are they supposed to do? If you've sent all these people to prison and you now, especially if you now admit that many of them shouldn't have been there in the first place, you've got to do a better job. You've got to do a better job of helping all of us, find the way back to being fellow citizens and fellow workers with them. And we're just hopeless on that front. I mean, there are some very good people working on this, but given the scale of the problem, there aren't enough.
All right, that was Kwame Anthony Appiah, philosopher, cultural theorist, and novelist, and the writer on ethics for the New York Times Magazine. And I was talking with him on the first day of Rise Up October. All right, well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of our guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, and now we're going to go out with a song that's just too damn appropriate for this whole show. It's Which Side Are You On? From Talib Kweli and Ninth Wonder. Check this out.
Which side are you on, friend? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, friend? Which side are you on? Justice for my crown, please. Justice for us all. Justice for my crown, please. Justice for us all.
It was a thought.
Which side are you on,
yeah,
boy? Which side are
the
you on?
The silence is unappreciated.
Which side are
I'ma
you
go ahead and take this disrespect.
Boy, which side are you on?
Silence is
boy,
death, yes.
Which side are you on?
Get off the fence, son.
Which side are you on?
Get off the bench,
boy,
son.
Which side are you
who
on?
Who stands to defend
boy,
us? If you ain't with us, you against daughter. Us.
We're drawing a line in the sand. The witness or a guest has got to decide where you stand. There's an angel and a demon inside of every man.